Wednesday, April 14th, 771 East Christie Avenue, New Avalon, Zeta Cygni. The grandfather clock in the front room was just striking 10 a.m. when Anne Cross arrived in the hall, bounding down the stairs two at a time with her overnight bag in one hand and her sword in the other. Caitlin Sensei was already there waiting for her, an Aldera 2408 promotional backpack, part of the swag from Juri's brief but eventful career as an Olympic fencer, slung on one of her shoulders. Both women were dressed all wrong for the weather. It was a beautiful spring day outside, yet they were bundled up in their warmest clothes, with heavy coats and knit caps. Caitlin was even wearing a pair of big, clod-hopping, Mickey Mouse cold-weather boots, the military surplus kind with the aviation pressure relief valve on the side. "All set?" Kate asked her student. "All set," Anne confirmed, then added with a wry grin, "assuming our ride gets here before I melt." Sergei the Tiger gave her what she perceived as a dubious look, as if to remark that he had his fur on all the time, and it wasn't a problem for him, so what was she complaining about? Before Kate could reply, the frosted floor-to-ceiling window next to the front door began to glow, rays of yellow light fanning out from the center of the panel to suffuse its whole surface, and then Corwin emerged as if stepping through a waterfall. "Morning," he said cheerfully. Like them, he was dressed in polar gear. His appeared to be mostly fur and hide, reminding Anne of the ancient movie they'd watched in Mr. Hall's social studies class about the people who had lived in the Arctic on pre-contact Earth. He could have done with some beard maintenance, but otherwise showed few signs of being a man who had a slightly less than a month old offspring to contend with. "Good morning, Corwin," said Kate, giving him a hug. "Shall we?" "Step this way, ladies and tiger," he replied, gesturing to the still glowing window. "Mind the gap." Anne thought he was being funny until she stepped through the sheet of light, at which point she discovered that there was a slight discontinuity. The window he'd used on the other side didn't go quite all the way to the ground. As she emerged, careful not to trip, and not to think too hard about what she might be tripping on, given that she was traversing a dimensional barrier as well as a lot of interstellar space in that one step, the cold struck her in the face, momentarily taking her breath away. If she'd been wearing glasses, she fancied they'd have frosted over instantly. In fact, looking at Caitlin, she saw that her senseis actually had. On the other hand, she no longer regretted her heavy wool coat or the scarf around her neck, and once she got her bearings, she realized that the place where she had just arrived was absolutely gorgeous. The town itself was not so special, just a small collection of buildings in a style her instincts automatically, if incorrectly, tagged as sort of Viking, maybe. But it was set in a bowl of craggy hills and snowy mountains, and the sky those mountains reared up toward was huge and of a piercingly pure blue. Anne was momentarily distracted from this reflection by the sound of a very large dog barking for joy, and then the peerless sight of Neri, all 8 feet and probably 1,000 pounds of her, actually capering with delight as she and Serge renewed their acquaintance. Cora was still laughing about it herself as she trotted over to hug first Kate, then Anne. "Hey, you two," she declared. "Welcome to my hometown. Or welcome back, in Kate's case. Kate, you remember Nanuruk and Kena?" The morning was a whirl of introductions, or in most cases, reintroductions for Kate, and little discoveries. Preparations for the evening's festival were in full swing by the time the New Avalon contingent arrived, with people out hanging up decorations or otherwise sprucing up the broad common space in the middle of town. At one end, some were constructing what was obviously the burn pile for a bonfire. At the other, another group was setting up a small stage, alongside which loomed a large shape covered in a white cloth. Around the perimeter, still other townsfolk were setting up what looked like market stalls. The whole scene hummed with a sense of cheerful bustle. At mid-afternoon, Nall caused an enormous ruckus by arriving in the most ostentatious possible style, setting down in the middle of the common with a great flourish of his feathered wings, before furling them and lowering his head to let his passenger disembark. Utna was intrigued to see the good people of Senna's reaction to such blatant draconic show-offery. They rushed toward the common, exclaiming excitedly, many of them scrambling for cameras. He preened for them a bit, making Utna roll her eyes and Anthy laugh, before causing another ripple of excitement by switching to his humanoid form right there in front of everybody. Next to all that, nobody seemed to notice Lakpa for a moment, which was unusual in the experience of most people who knew her. Admittedly, she wasn't looking her best, bundled up in air nomad foul weather gear with her hair in hopeless disarray. But even under the circumstances, she managed to make looking windblown and slightly chapped seem glamorous somehow. "Wow, Nall," Maki remarked as she and the others went to greet the newest arrivals. "Could you possibly have oversold that a little more?" Cora grinned. "I hope you've got your ID on you. As soon as some of these pictures hit the lightning web, Master Chin's liable to be on the next Nanisevic flight out of Tenzin International, thinking you're one of the local rarities come out of hiding." "Eh, it's all good. I warned him ahead of time," said Nall. "Good plan," she told him. Then, turning to Lakpa, she asked, "How'd you get Janora to agree to this? She's not usually big on random field trips at your age." Lakpa smiled the smile of a person who is up to something and replied, "Oh, as far as great-grand-grand knows, I've gone to the Southern Air Temple." Adopting a slightly mocking version of a meditative stance, she added, "The better to reflect upon the avatars of the past, you know." "Ah," said Cora, nodding, then added conversationally, "You don't seriously think you got away with that, do you?" Lakpa frowned and started to ask what she meant, but before she had a chance, Nanuruk arrived to find out what all the commotion was about, and matters became too boomy and bear-huggy for meaningful conversation. Preparations for the festival continued into the short polar afternoon. By dusk, everything was set up, and a small group of the village's swiftest runners were making a ceremonial circuit of the common, lighting the evenly spaced decorative torches that were necessary to give the occasion its proper ambiance. The village common was starting to fill up, both with residents and visitors arriving in town from neighboring, relatively speaking, communities. Off to the northwest, the sun plunged behind the mountains as if in a hurry to be done with the day, briefly painting that corner of the sky in spectacular roseate colors, while, at the opposite end, the Aurora Australis was already starting to flicker among the emerging stars. It was into this colorfully expectant atmosphere that another aerial visitor arrived, the great cream and brown bulk of a sky bison, swooping in from the north to land just about where Nall had a few hours before. Vayu, Corwin would have known him anywhere, drew almost as great a crowd as Nall had, and cameras flashed anew in the twilight as his rider alighted from his head. Unlike Lakpa, Nemo was dressed in the most formal of air nomad robes, the sort worn by master airbenders for ceremonial and state occasions, similar to the White Lotus dress robes she'd worn to help Chiang and Caitlin collect Emily Wong, but in the standard air nomad palette of saffron, yellow, and red. This had a cloak, but was otherwise startlingly lightweight-looking for this weather. She was even bareheaded, though at least by now her hair had grown back in to the point where her scalp wasn't readily visible. "Greetings, Elder Nanuruk," she said, making her most elegant airbender courtesy to the man in the obvious Angakuk finery. "I am Master Nima of the Central Air Temple. The Apsara Lama sends her most cordial regards on the occasion of this great celebration." Corwin remarked to himself with a little smile that, poor girl, she was probably expecting the village's chief notable to show a little gravitas at this point, and assuming that Nanuruk wouldn't remember that they had met before. Nima had only been 7 the one time she'd been here before, after all, and she had the habit of thinking herself unmemorable. What she got, however, was not a waterbender salute and some fine words in reply. It was a cry of, "Great spirits, look at you!" that people probably heard over in Kurluktuk, and a hug that even a startled master airbender couldn't quite evade. Nima was still a little red-faced and flustered as Nanuruk ushered her over to display her to Kena. "You remember, she was only about this high!" and show her that Korra's various other friends were already on hand. If she were further surprised in any way to find Lakpa among the group that awaited her, she showed no sign. Showed, in fact, no sign that she had even noticed her sister among them, a feat which Lakpa did not quite manage to reciprocate fully. Within an hour, night had fully fallen, and the festival was underway. Despite its foreboding name, the Falling Dark Festival was in no way a gloomy or fearful affair. Rather, it had the air of a scaled-up family gathering, warm and convivial, but also relaxed and casual. Even Korra herself was obviously not principally an eminent personage to these people, but part of their family, often literally. And as part of this community celebration, she was welcomed home as such, not as some kind of exalted stranger. So, too, were Karana, who was plainly also a sort of local celebrity, and Azana, who appeared not far behind her in the esteem of many townsfolk. Observing that last fact, and knowing what she had lately learned about the history of this world, Anthy found it pleasing that Karana's relations and neighbors had found it possible to take a foreigner, a firebender, no less, to their hearts so completely, and in light of it, less surprising that they had done likewise for Corwin and his family, including herself. In spite of, perhaps because of, the cold ruggedness of their homeland, these were a warm and kindly people, both big and open-hearted. It reminded her a bit of the way Utna's duelist family had accepted her, the perennial outsider, when she had arrived, still a bit shell-shocked and timorous, in their midst. The thought put her in a warm and happy frame of mind, not that any other kind would have been easy to sustain in the face of all the easy congeniality that was happening all around her. Even the lingering, faintly awkward tension between the airbender sisters couldn't put a dent in the mood, and both of them seemed to be making an effort to keep it from threatening to do so, which struck Anthy as encouragingly tactful on Lakpa's part. At one point fairly early on, most of the from-far-away contingent were standing all together at one of the booths near the middle of the common, enjoying some sort of mulled cider beverage served hot in wooden mugs, when Karana appeared out of the crowd and joined them. At some point that morning she'd sewn a panel of light blue fabric, actually a piece cut from a t-shirt, onto the front of her amautik. This bore the stylized likeness of Korra's face, rendered as a semi-abstract smiley face icon. Many people in town had attached such items to their coats, in fact. It was evidently something of a tradition. But as far as Corwin had noticed, only Karana had taken a black marker and captioned hers, "Gran Gran," in big, cheerful letters. Like the image of Korra on her parka, Karana was smiling from ear to ear as she approached. In her amout, she carried a baby, a little older than Annabelle. This one was able to hold up her head and look around, which she was doing with every appearance of happy interest in the sights and sounds of the festival all around. "Hey, gang," said Karana cheerfully. "Isn't this great? Gonna be the best one for years. I can feel it already." "Whose baby have you borrowed this time?" asked Anthy with a smile. "Ha! Remember when I told you about being the world's greatest honorary aunt?" Karana asked in reply. "Turns out I am in fact the world's greatest actual aunt. Have been for nearly 9 months now, and nobody told me." She shook her head. "Honestly, sometimes I wonder about these people. Anyway, everybody, this is my niece." She paused, waiting until Azana was in the midst of taking a sip of her cider, then added with a slightly wicked grin, "Kazana." Azana, no K, sputtered, nearly spraying Corwin with hot cider, but managed to avert that catastrophe and get it down instead. "And you thought Towsie didn't approve of you," said Karana with a smug little smile as her partner gave her a reproachful look. "Aw, she's a cutie," said Garnet, leaning in for a closer look, but, lesson learned, being careful to stay out of grabbing distance. "How did you go 9 months without learning that your brother and his wife have a child?" Maki wondered. "Well, Mom and Dad didn't think to mention it, because they assumed Towsie would," said Karana. She folded her arms with a little scowl. "And of course he didn't. When I called him on it a minute ago, he just said, 'Duh, I didn't think you'd be interested,'" she added in an exaggerated dumb guy voice. "That's actually not hard to believe at all," said Izana after a moment's consideration. "I love my big brother," Karana said, "but sometimes I just want to punch him right in the head. Not that that would improve matters any, so I suppose I won't, huh?" she added with a wry look over her shoulder at her niece, who giggled at the expression. Not long after, the village elders took to the little stage at the far end of the common and signaled for attention. From all around the common, the people of Senna and their visitors converged, momentarily suspending all other pursuits to gather before the stage. Once they were all together and quieted down a bit, Nanuruk spoke, requiring, Uchina noted with a smile, no PA system to be heard. "Friends, neighbors, we gather as we always do, to bid the sun farewell for another winter. But we should make it clear to our new brother and sisters, and our visiting friends, that we do not do this in a spirit of gloom or fear. This festival is not ironically named, for we of the Southern Water Tribe do not fear the polar night. We welcome it, we embrace it, as one of the things that makes our home what it is. A unique place, a place of extremes. A place to be lived with, not in. To be worked with, not against." Sounds of agreement and approval rose from the crowd. Becoming still more animated, Nanuruk went on, "The South Pole is not a place to be tamed." "No," someone cried. "No more than we, our people, to be tamed," Nanuruk thundered. "Never! Hear him! And so we gather to celebrate the fall of night," the Angakuk went on, his sonorous voice moderating slightly. "Not in fear, but in hope. As we wait for the sun to return, the dark brings us all the closer to our old and treasured friend, Yue, the moon." Holding up an admonishing finger, he added, "But here in Senna, she's not the only dear friend we gather to celebrate on this day. Today is also the anniversary of our village's most famous and honored daughter. She doesn't like us to make a fuss about her, and for most of the year we don't." He grinned mischievously. "But she can't escape it on her birthday. Brothers and sisters, Avatar Korra!" As her neighbors, and in many cases distant relatives, cheered and applauded around her, Korra smiled an embarrassed, indulgent smile and, red-faced, raised her hand in a self-deprecating little wave, letting them get on with it. For those few of you who may not know, Korra has a long-standing policy against letting people put up statues in her honor, said Nanuruk once the cheering died down. As part of our celebration of her birthday, we ignore that as well, he added, drawing a laugh. This year's has been constructed under the supervision of another of our own who has gone on to fame and fortune on the outside, but never forgotten her roots. Here to unveil her creation is my very own daughter, number 7 of the Temple Island Fire Ferrets, Karana. Sporting a huge grin and clearly not at all embarrassed about the cheers and applause of her neighbors, Karana bounded onto the stage, still packing her niece. A laugh made the rounds as people noticed the caption on her smiley Korra decoration. "Hello," she declared. "I'm glad the league schedule worked out so I could get home for the festival this time. I'd like to thank the elders for choosing me to design this year's sculpture. And no, Mom and Dad didn't vote, she quipped with a wink, drawing another laugh. Anyway, happy birthday, Cora. I call this The Journey, and I hope you like it. At a signal from her, a small ring of floodlights arranged around the white-draped object next to the stage flicked on, bathing it in a clean, bright light. A group of the village's youth hauled on ropes strategically affixed to the white cloth covering the sculpture, pulling it clear in such a way that it didn't drag over the artwork itself. As it fluttered away, what lay beneath almost seemed to glow in the floodlights, and the festival-goers made a delighted sound. As it did every year, the sculpture depicted Cora, but this year she wasn't alone. Meticulously rendered at approximately twice life-size, she sat astride a polar bear dog, sitting tall in the saddle. Her face was rendered in a cheerful smile, looking optimistically off to whatever she was riding toward. And walking along with them, also wrought in loving detail, were Anthy, Utina, and Corwin, shown in the same Water Tribe-style clothes the real ones were wearing a few yards away. Anthy was even carrying Annabelle in her amout and Garnet on her shoulder, hiking with staff in hand. Utina and Corwin seemed to be consulting a document of some kind, perhaps a map. Anthy, though slightly preoccupied, being surprised by their inclusion, couldn't suppress a giggle at how perfectly Corwin's, well, I don't know, face had been captured by the sculptor. Looking at the piece, her own likeness and those of her friends perfectly captured in matte-finished ice that gleamed like frosted glass, Cora felt her eyes tearing up and didn't bother fighting it. It was a perfect metaphoric encapsulation of how she'd come to feel lately, with the 3, 4, 5 of them having burst so suddenly and colorfully into her life. Life was a journey, she had always felt it so, and Corwin's family had joined her on the road. A road which of late had begun to seem a bit lonely. She wondered how Karana knew all that well enough to capture it so perfectly in ice. Before she could explore the thought too deeply, she looked at the sculpture more closely, and a fresh wave of sentiment washed over her as she realized that the polar bear dog her icy representation was riding wasn't Neri. The differences were very subtle. She suspected that, apart from the artist, she was the only person there who would notice them. But there they were, unmistakable. That was Naga, Neri's several greats grandmother. The original polar bear dog Cora had found as an orphaned pup and raised by hand when she herself was but a child, establishing the first and only line of domesticated polar bear dogs to be found anywhere in the world. How did you know? She wondered again, looking at Karana's beaming profile as the younger woman stood and enjoyed the other's admiration of her handiwork. There's more to that girl than I sometimes assume, Cora told herself, dashing at her happy tears before they could freeze on her face. I have to remember that. After the unveiling, most of those gathered adjourned to the other end of the common, and it became obvious now why the bonfire pile was set up there, so that the fire's heat wouldn't endanger the ice sculpture. Karana cajoled Azana into lighting it, naturally, and everyone seemed delighted with the result. Then the drums came out, and the dancing started. A short while later, while Karana, having returned her niece to her sister-in-law, was taking a break from drumming and getting another cider with Azana, a teenage boy broke away from a group of his peers off to one side and came over to join them. "Hey, Kuvi, what's up?" Karana asked. "Having a good time?" "Hey, Karana," said the boy, grinning. "Great so far. Nice work on this year's statue." "Thanks. You remember Azana?" "Sure," Kuvi said with a nod. "Have you been?" "So far, so good," said Azana, smiling. Pleasantries observed, Kuvi leaned toward Karana with a slightly furtive expression, gestured vaguely toward another part of the common, and said, "Do you know who that is?" Karana looked. "Which one? There's like 20 people over there. she said wryly. Kuvi tried to point more specifically without completely abandoning discretion. "Oh, that's Nima," said Karana. Then she gave the young man a curious look and added, "Why?" "She's amazing," said Kuvi. Asana had to concentrate quite hard not to laugh. He would probably have taken it the wrong way, either assuming she was mocking him or his taste in girls, when really she just found the whole business entertaining on its own merits. Karana glanced at her, made sure she was going to be able to maintain control, then turned back to the boy and said, "She's an air nomad, Kuvi." Kuvi shrugged. "Well, okay, and?" Karana thought about that for a second, then conceded, "Yeah, fair enough. Come on, I'll introduce you," she said, then handed her cider to Asana, clapped Kuvi on the shoulder, and set briskly off across the common. Nima was standing off to one side watching the festivities, but she wasn't in wallflower mode, just observing. She had a particular fondness for ancient traditional celebrations, and despite the relatively recent addition of Avatar Korra's birthday to the program, the Falling Dark Festival was old indeed. As old as the Water Tribe itself, as old as Waterbender's reverence for the Moon Spirit. In other parts of the South Pole, she knew, the date of the festival still varied, moving to coincide with the first full moon after the fall equinox. Only in this region did it always fall on April 14th, and only for the last 120 or so years. She looked up at the moon, gleaming down amid the shimmering aurora, and smiled to herself. She doubted very much whether Yue minded the people of Senna and its environs moving their holiday to celebrate their favorite native daughter as well. That train of thought was interrupted as Karana approached, half leading and half dragging a startled-looking youth of about Nima's own age along with her. She thought she detected a resemblance between them as they approached, and for a moment she wondered whether he might be Karana's younger brother Bori. But then she remembered that he was about Corwin's age, not in his middle teens. Karana solved the mystery a moment later, saying, "Nima, hey! This is my cousin, Kuvi Utuk." Putting a hand on the boy's shoulder, she grinned and went on, "I'll warn you now, he's only a so-so hunter. But hey, you're a vegetarian, so it's all good, right? Plus, he tells good stories, so he'll probably make a passable Anga cook in a few years." With a wink, she added, "You could totally do worse, is what I'm saying." "Karana!" Kuvi blurted, his face going crimson, which, in fairness, was no more than Nima's was doing. "Kuvi," Karana went on, undaunted, "this is Master Nima. She grew up on an island full of monks, but don't let that fool you, she's pretty hardcore." Pushing the two teenagers to within arm's length of each other, she said, "You kids have fun now," and then turned and trotted back to Asana, her mission accomplished. "Are you sure that was a good idea, Rana?" asked Asana, handing her partner back her cup of cider. Karana grinned and knocked back what remained in the cup. "Oh, relax. Kuvi's even more afraid of girls than Bori used to be." She gestured with the empty vessel at her cousin and Nima, now out of earshot. It was plain from their red faces and awkward body language that they were having a very tentative conversation indeed, but they were still having one, and Karana's grin became a bit sentimental as she added, "If they really hit it off tonight, maybe he'll ask her to the movers when they're about 20, which is more or less Nima's speed too, I expect." She elbowed Asana. "Come on, tell me they aren't cute together." "Adorable, actually," Asana conceded after a moment's consideration. "Where is Bori?" she wondered. "Med school in Nani," Karana replied. "Finals in a couple of weeks, so he didn't think he could get away. He'll be free for Glacier Spirits, though." She smiled slyly and added, "And looking forward to seeing you again, no doubt." "Well," said Asana with mock pragmatism, "in my line of work, a doctor would be pretty handy." Then she smiled, finished her own cider, and they went to turn in the cups and rejoin the drum dance. As such things all but inevitably do in societies with a significant cultural interest in martial arts, the dance blended into a series of demonstrations, both by the village's several waterbenders and some non-bending members of the local militia. A few of the visitors got in on the action as well. Karana and Azana, after much cajoling from friends and neighbors, not least Karana's parents, put on a brief exhibition of some of their flashiest pro-bending tricks, at one point dragooning Corwin to stand in again for the absent Xiang Wan. Maki, of course, was more than happy to demonstrate some of her Kyoshi warrior techniques. To everyone's slight surprise, even Nima and Lakpa got into the spirit of the thing, stepping past recent events to show off some airbender moves, their coordination perfect despite the lingering tension between them. After them, the occasion seemed to be reaching a sort of natural climax. When they finished their kata, bowed, and left the impromptu dueling ring that had developed spontaneously in the middle of the common, people began to call Korra's name. She waved them off at first with a good-natured smile, insisting that it wasn't her night to show off. But they wouldn't be denied, and soon the entire village seemed to be in on the act, chanting her name like the crowd at a ball game. There were only a few hundred of them, but in this familiar space, after such an evening, their energy was all but irresistible. She seemed just about to give in and show them a thing or two, when, with a slightly wicked little smile, Anthy caught her eye. With a quick, hard-to-follow movement of her right hand, the Sephirian priestess was suddenly holding two roses, one white, the other an almost iridescent pale blue. Behind her, Utna grinned and raised a challenging eyebrow. Korra blinked in surprise, then started to spread her hands in a shrug. No weapon, before she noticed that Karana had come up next to her and was offering her one. Master Sokka's meteor sword, retrieved at a run from her house. For a moment she was completely baffled, looking from her young relative to the priestess to the prince, then at Corwin, curious as to his reaction to this development. He grinned, gave her a wink, and suddenly it all just made sense, somehow. She returned the grin, then turned to Karana, saluted her gravely, and drew the meteor sword from its scabbard. With the black blade in hand, she strode out into the middle of the dueling ring, to the tumultuous cheering of her hometown crowd. Utna and Anthy walked out to meet her. With great ceremony, Anthy affixed the blue rose to Korra's anorak and the white to Utna's, then silenced the crowd with awe by drawing the sword of Utna's heart from her in a blaze of light and placing it in her hand. Smiling beatifically, Anthy bowed with an airbender salute to the Avatar, kissed her husband, and withdrew, crossing to stand by Corwin and the others. For a long, silent moment, Korra and Utna just stood regarding each other, their faces still, almost solemn. Then Utna grinned, Korra did likewise, and the duel began. They started out, as Kate and Utna had started out in the first rose duel Anne Cross had ever seen, with just their swords and the skills they had for wielding them. No bending, no overt magic, nothing but muscle and nerve and steel. In this, they were about evenly matched. Utna was a few inches taller, her reach commensurately longer, and she still had the raw talent that had seen her through a deadly tournament with virtually no training in the handling of a blade, now tempered with 7 years' hard-fought experience. But Korra was wily, with a century and more of life on the front line behind her, even if most of it hadn't been sword fights. "I've never seen anyone handle a sword like Korra does before," Juniper murmured to her sensei a minute or so into the display. Kate agreed softly. "I'm told that when I was around 2, not long after she first met Dad, she more or less hypnotized me by doing an exercise in the dojo at our house with a Jian he used to have. There's a reason they call it the Gentleman of Weapons." She smiled. "I don't remember that day directly. I was much too young. But it left a mark on me all the same. When I was little, I thought kenjutsu was sort of brutal, ungraceful. It was only later that I learned to appreciate the katana's directness and elegance. But I've always had a special place in my heart for the jian. Anne nodded, but said nothing more. She was too absorbed in the spectacle before her. Both women were superb athletes, perfectly in tune with their bodies' capabilities and limits. Both were adept, not to say inspired, improvisers, with an almost extrasensory level of situational awareness. And neither seemed to have been paying attention the day moderation was the topic of discussion in class. If they had confined themselves solely to this level, the battle that ensued would still have been one of the most exciting and technically impressive most of the people watching it had ever seen. But, of course, Korra was Korra and Uchino was Uchino, so they didn't. Korra escalated first, twisting away from Uchino's lightning riposte, then launching a pneumatic shockwave, like the one she'd tried on Corwin during their sparring match on the latter's wedding day, as a natural complement to the move. Corwin had replied with an earthbending counter, summoning a windbreak from the ground, but Uchino neither had nor evidently required such recourse. Instead, her teeth showing in a fierce little grin, she parried the wave of compressed air with her sword. And to the astonishment of most onlookers, the black-streaked silver blade of the Heart of the Rose cleaved the wind, the scarlet runes of the Valkyrie's creed rising on the sides of the slender blade as the divided shockwave passed to either side of her and blasted up clouds of snow. These hid her from view, but only for an instant, whereupon she burst from the curtain of ice crystals as if fired from a cannon, uttering a Kleonese battle cry she'd learned from Professor Krog, and trailing a faint but distinctly visible crimson aura behind her. At the sight of this suddenly amplified form of her foe, Korra grinned as well and shifted up another gear. Taking a half-step back, she removed a hand from Space Sword's grip and used it to raise a sheet of the snowpack from underfoot, hardening it into a glittering wall of solid ice, which held Uchino up about as much as the decorative banner across the stadium entrance holds up a football team at the start of the game. It smashed into chunks as if rammed by a truck, as the Prince of Sephiro, her aura now a brilliantly obvious scarlet, sprang right through it. Those who were watching closely, and that was basically everybody here, noticed an interesting undercurrent as the duel between the Avatar and the Prince heated up. With every escalation, the smiles on both women's faces grew wider. Neither one became grim or purposeful as their levels of concentration and commitment ramped ever upward. Instead, both displayed nothing but an ever-increasing joy of battle. It was a fierce joy, to be certain, but it was joy, all the same. Facing an opponent surrounded by shining, irresistible power of a kind rarely seen in Dicho before, not one element or another, but seemingly just pure energy, Korra unpacked her entire toolbox in response. Unleashing all four elements in the face of Uchina's onslaught, she employed every technique she knew in a counter-offensive that could have stymied an army. Very few people, benders or not, could expect to stand for long against the absolutely undivided attention of a fully realized, highly experienced avatar. But Uchino Tenjo did far more than merely hold her own. She rose to meet the challenge, her technique becoming yet swifter and surer. She was fully in the zone, with a counter to hand for everything Korra offered. Dauntless and unhesitating, she faced and conquered situations that would have terrified an ordinary mortal. Springing with superhuman agility and speed between slabs of stone and sheets of ice, dodging whips of freezing water by hair's breadths, turning aside blasts of nearly solid air and sizzling streams of compressed fire as though they were thrown softballs. In one furious full-on rush, she bowled through everything Korra threw at her and closed to within grappling range of the Avatar, too close for either woman to use her sword effectively. Korra, by far the more experienced hand-to-hand fighter, tried for a leg sweep, but she herself had already taught Uchino how to counter that. The Rose Prince jumped over it, spun into an airbender-style evasion, and drove out an elbow to the upper chest that dropped the Avatar cleanly to the ground, and wrenched a collective gasp from everyone in Senna. Korra slid a few yards across the smooth-packed snow of the arena, the wind driven out of her. As she went, her eyes flashed, the white glow of the Avatar state blanking out the blue merriment that had all but crackled in them throughout the duel. Before she would have come to a halt, she twisted her body into an air nomad whirlwind kick, springing upward in a swirl of ice chips and hard air to a single-handed handstand and sending off a titanic crescent shockwave toward Utena in the process. Without time or space to perform a proper counter, Utena set herself, like an earthbender, several observers noticed, and just took it, letting it drive her clean to the edge of the arena, but keeping her feet. She came to rest within arm's length of Anthy, her long pink hair and the slack in her parka sleeves whipping. Still in motion, never stopping, Korra completed the handspring and somersaulted upright, but not to her feet. The cyclone kick, fueled by the full power of the Avatar state, had enclosed her in a spherical shell of rushing air, within which she levitated, toes not quite touching the ground. Whirling once, she summoned a tight ring of fire to orbit outside the air shell. Again, and she tore a ribbon of the snowpack free and melted it into a complementary ring of water. As she swung out of the follow-through of the second ring's creation, she burst into forward motion again, surfing toward her opponent at the crest of a wave of rippling earth that buckled the snow crust atop it and threw it aside, making straight for her opponent, the tip of Space Sword drawing a rooster tail of flame in its wake as it sliced through the air. Utena wasn't daunted by this development either. Without hesitation, she flipped the heart of the rose in her hands and offered its point to Anthy, who, with a rather wicked little smile, leaned forward and kissed it delicately. White fire raced up the black veins in the blade, lighting up the already glowing Valkyrie runes as if they were burning from within, and suffused the prince's scarlet aura with streaks of white lightning. With the fiercest grin she'd yet sported, Utena stepped away from the priestess and raised her sword in a crusader's salute, kissing the crossbar of the hilt. As her lips touched the metal, a brilliantly glowing sigil appeared on her unmarked forehead, as if illuminated from within like the runes on her sword. A circle, roughly the size of an old Earth Kingdom yuan, crossed with a jaggedly bent line that called to mind a lightning bolt. It was visible for only an instant, there and gone in the blink of an eye. But Anthy saw it, and so too did Corwin, whose own Aesir brand flickered as if in sympathy as his eyes went wide with surprise. And they stayed that way, for Utena, her auras of scarlet and white blending into a single brilliant rose with a crack like a sonic boom, met Korra's full-on charge with one of her own, crossing the dwindling space between them with one of the great hunting cat leaps that had become her signature in the waning days of the Lost Tournament. The heart of the rose, like a splinter of the Aurora in its prince's hand, met the flame-sheathed blade of Sokka's meteor sword with a lightning-like flash that dazzled the eyes of the onlookers. Utena's rose-pink corona and Korra's elemental shells blended into a confusion of light, color, and shape as the two silhouetted figures at their centers met, merged, and parted again, traveling in opposite directions. Utena landed near the center of the arena, down on one knee, the light receding from the streaks and runes of her sword as the glow of her aura faded. Korra came to rest not far from where Utena had started, the ground around her blasted down to bare rock by the tremendous forces unleashed, Space Sword's blade visibly steaming in the cold night air. Both women's shoulders rose and fell sharply as they caught their breath, not moving, not speaking. No one spoke. For a full 5 seconds there wasn't a sound. Then, slowly, they rose to their feet and turned to face one another. On the ground midway between them, the pale blue rose that had been on Korra's chest lay scattered like a bomb burst, its denuded central bud smoldering gently. Utena's was still right where Anthy had pinned it. The onlookers remained quiet, trying to take in what that meant, as Cora silently handed Space Sword back to Karana for her to put away in its sheath, then walked slowly across the battered battlefield toward Utrinna. A few paces away, she stopped, composed herself, and with perfect gravity made the waterbender salute, bowing deeply to the victorious duelist. Utrinna, for her part, raised the Heart of the Rose in a crusader salute once more. When she snapped it down and away at the completion of that gesture, it glowed brightly, then dissolved into a spray of silvery sparks that rose upward and dissipated into the night, leaving her hand empty. Another long, silent moment passed. And then the two women came together in a fierce, broadly grinning embrace, tears of unrestrained and largely uncategorized emotion welling in their eyes, and the onlookers at last burst into cheers. To be sure, their hometown heroine had been vanquished before their eyes, and that was a bit of a shock, but it was done with such verve, and Cora was taking it with such grace, that the admiration they showed was genuine and unstinting. After the duel, dinner, Falling Dark style. Cora and her friends ate Arctic hen with hot sauce and some kind of fried tubers out of paper cones with disposable chopsticks, standing up, in a little group not far from the stand that had provided the food. "Now this is civilized," Utrinna remarked with a smile. "Everybody having a good time?" Cora inquired, drawing a round of "Are you kidding?" laughs. "Hey, it's only polite to check." "Does anyone come here and not have a good time?" Anne wondered, looking around at the town square. The hour was growing late, and at this time of year it had been dark since early afternoon anyway, but the festival showed no sign of slowing down. A couple of youngsters had used a waterbending trick to zamboni the middle of the square, where the sparring arena had been, and were now out there ice skating. All around the perimeter, people still stood around in little groups, much like they were, eating, drinking, talking, laughing. Karana, noticing something about the skating youths, laughed and elbowed Azana. The firebender looked, then smiled. Out on the sheet of ice, Kuvi seemed to have taken it upon himself to teach Nima how to ice skate. Both fire ferrets knew that the young air nomad was probably a better skater than he was, because of her natural grace and because it was an activity Katara had introduced to Air Temple Island in the winters many years before. But she was playing along, pretending to go uncertainly, so as to permit him his attempt at gallantry. "What?" Anthy wondered, seeing the two of them smiling. Then she turned and looked as well. "Ah." She, in turn, nudged Corwin. He looked up from projecting for Caitlin a general arrangement diagram of the house he and Cora were designing, then grinned and called her attention to the pair, and so forth. "Aw, that's sweet," said Maki. For a few moments they all stood, eating in silence, and watched the little scene unfolding. Then a voice nearer to hand called them from the reverie, saying, "Excuse me, Avatar Cora?" Cora turned, a questioning look on her face, to see a young water tribesman she didn't recognize standing nearby. He had the undefinable air of a city boy about him, something about the cut of his parka, maybe, or his slightly fancier-than-usual hairstyle, and he was carrying a large camera. With her eyes on him, he hesitated, almost making a break for it, but then bucked himself up and said, "My name's Kapi. I'm with the Nanisivik News. Do you mind? Can I get a photo of you and your new team?" "What is it with us and reporters lately?" Cora wondered with a wry little grin. "Some folks got it," Corwin remarked. Next to him, Minami nodded sagely. "True," Cora agreed. "What do you guys think?" Shrugs and nods all around. She turned back to the young newsman and said, "Sure, but do you think your deadline will survive if we finish eating first?" Kapi blushed a bit. "Of course. That is, however you want to arrange..." I mean... Cora laughed and clapped him on the shoulder. Relax, kid. It's not a problem. She held up her paper cone. Have you tried the Arctic Hen? You really should. They posed for a half dozen shots, just in case, and then sent the relieved young stringer on his way with a cone of hen and spuds of his own. Cora watched him go, his antennae already alert for other photo opportunities, and chuckled. They get younger all the time, she said. And then, out of nowhere, yawned apocalyptically. Whew! That's my cue, I think, she said with a nod. You guys can stick around if you want. If it's anything like previous years, this party's going to go all night. But I think I'll call it a day. Grinning, she nudged Utina with an elbow and added, You were pretty rough on the old lady. Utina snorted with cheerful scorn. Old lady indeed, she said, rolling her eyes. In the end, they all agreed it was just about bedtime. And so, with thanks and hugs for Nanuruk, Kena, and a number of the other local worthies, the whole group excused themselves and slipped away to Korra's house. Azana, Karana, Maki, and the Satos intended to leave them at the door and retire to their own sleeping quarters, either at Karana's parents' house or the bunkhouse out back. But before they could do so, Utina asked them to step in for a moment. Intrigued, they did so. Cora's little living room was a tad crowded with this many people in it, to say nothing of Neri and Surge, but not too badly, and there was an air of expectancy as they all gathered and waited for the pink-haired duelist's explanation. Did you bring it? Utina asked Caitlin. Of course, Kate replied. With a gentle smile, she removed a small object from an inside pocket and gave it to Utina without revealing it to everyone else. Utina grinned at her, then sobered, turned to Cora and said solemnly, Yesterday, you welcomed the three of us, gesturing to Anthe and Corwin, into your tribe and your family. Tonight? Pausing, she raised her left hand, holding it in a fist against her chest for a moment. Then, with a smile, she said, Tonight it's our turn, extended the hand to Cora, and opened it. On her palm, a silver ring inlaid with the duelist rose crest glinted in the firelight, much like Cora's eyes as they widened in surprise. The avatar slowly reached out and took the ring from Utrina's palm. Holding it between her right thumb and forefinger, she stood looking at it for several seconds, her face almost blank. Presently, she slid it onto the third finger of her left hand with an almost reverent deliberation, before holding out her hand to regard it for a moment more. Her eyes misting over once again, she embraced Utrina. Anthe and Annabelle joined in a moment later, then Corwin, then Kate. Then, after some tearfully grinning gestures from somewhere inside the pile, all the rest as well. Cora couldn't remember the last time there had been an all-hands team avatar group hug. She only knew that it had been too damn long.